This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Scrooge bosses steal from low-wage workers.
And now, the new president of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, called for tough new regulations on the financial industry and a new approach to making the U.S. economy responsive to working people. Trumka took to the streets as part of the new leadership's team's national tour to set out a jobs-focused, progressive vision for the economy and to fight back against the corporate agenda that left workers behind. Now we join the AFL-CIO President Trumka taking it to the streets. Wall Street, that is.
See, brothers and sisters, we're here today to demand more accountability from our financial system, from Wall Street, from the masters of the universe who speculate in phony instruments rather than invest in the real economy that creates jobs. More Americans will be unemployed this year than in decades. And the deepest recession since the Great Depression hasn't lost hold yet. Experts tell us that a million more foreclosures are coming. People will hurt. Banks and financial institutions must be held accountable for making this mess that required trillions of dollars of our money to clean up. For the pain that they've inflicted on families who face financial ruin, unemployment, wiped out pensions, foreclosures, and bankruptcy. Every American bank should be held responsible for correcting the course, and especially the practices that strangle commerce and kill jobs. Taking public money and paying huge bonuses to executives rather than investing in the economic engine that makes things go. Our financial system is in shambles, and we're not going to restore its luster until we rein in the abuse by financial institutions like AIG, Citi, Goldman Sachs, and other predators that pumped up the horrible housing bubble, that leveraged buyout bubble, and the hedge fund bubble until they burst. You see, we need a new model for the economy, because this broken, take-away-all-regulations model just doesn't work, and it can't work. The financial system is a public trust that's not unlike our electric grid system. Our whole economy depends on it working well. It can't be left unregulated like the deregulators of Wall Street really want, because people get hurt. And as they've proven time and again, the system crashes. See, we need a different model for our economy where good jobs and not bad debt drive our growth. Where workers have a real voice because they have a right to have a union if they want to. Where all of us have insurance and we have the choice of getting it without paying for insurance company executives' compensation packages. You see, our real economy needs a financial system that will support it and not a high-risk system that only supports itself and the wiliest speculators. And that means strict oversight of banks and other financial institutions that nearly drove our economy off a cliff. But there's been no accountability. Just business as usual right here on Wall Street. Nothing has changed. Their attitude hasn't changed. Just more and more of the same. More financial self-dealing while real people on Main Street are getting hurt. And it's getting worse every day. Unemployment will hit 10% this year, and it'll stay in double digits through next year. That's why we support President Obama's call here on Wall Street for tough new regulations. You see, we've let power concentrate to the point where just four banks control more than half the assets of the banking system. Three of them, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo, are too weak to be allowed to return their bailout money back to the government. And then there are AIG and Goldman Sachs, happily gambling in the derivatives market until the roof caves in. And we hand over $12 billion in public money to Goldman Sachs through AIG and didn't get a single share of Goldman Sachs stock in return. And we propped up Citigroup with $45 billion in public cash and $300 billion in guarantees. And here we are, a year after the roof caved in, and the same people are still running Citi. They're still running Bank of America. They're still running Wells Fargo and Goldman without any repercussions and without any accountability. We've got a message for Citi. We've got a message for AIG and every other financial institution getting rich at the expense of working families trying to recover from this recession. If you lock out families wanting home and businesses desperately needing capital to create jobs and new opportunities for families, if you take money from U.S. taxpayers and you spend it on more speculation instead of investing it in businesses that create jobs, if you lard your executives with bonuses and largesse while you're squeezing families out of their homes with unfair lending, you better get ready, because the American labor movement is going to fight you. We are going to tell the truth about you. We are going to fight you day and night until things change and we create an economy that works for every last American. That's why we're advocating new regulation, to make sure that the financial sector is the servant of the real economy and not its master. Brothers and sisters, families all over America are hurting because of irresponsible bank practices. 2 million homes will be lost to foreclosure by the end of the year. And experts tell us that millions more are to come. And it's because of greed. And it's because of irresponsibility of the big banks. And it's that simple. Taking advantage of homeowners, offering subprime loans, and then when that business collapses, using public money to fight the very financial reforms that are needed to stop them, instead of providing much-needed loans to families and businesses. We need banks to be accountable. The entire financial system must be accountable. Now, with the auto industry, the federal government set strict standards. They got rid of failed CEOs and they stopped executive compensation deals. You see, we need the same kind of square deal with the banks that we propped up, but they haven't delivered. Cash and credit are tight. Jobs have dried up. Executives are still being paid too handsomely. Our economy falters and people suffer, but the richest 1%, well, they're living high on the hog. And that, my brothers and sisters, friends and fellow citizens, is about to come to an end, because we will get the regulation of Wall Street that they need and we must have. That's why the labor movement stands with President Obama in his efforts for a strong consumer protection agency. But we want Congress to do much more. We need strong regulations of derivatives and hedge funds, sanctions to prevent speculative and dangerous transactions. And we stand with SEC Chairwoman Mary Shapiro and CFTC Chairman Gary Gensler in their fight for stronger regulations for hedge funds and derivatives and all the other crazy stuff that brought our economy down. You see, the global economy is emerging from near collapse and the risky ventures that drove us there. President Obama said he'd stimulate the economy with a plan to put people back to work, and he has so far. But there's a lot more to do. We need a sustained public investment program that is essential not only in our country but around the world, that continues to invest in jobs, 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 and more jobs. Global unions are calling for a global tax on short-term financial transactions to help pay for much-needed public investment and switch Wall Street from its short-termism to long-termism that creates jobs that pay a decent wage for all Americans. And that's why we joined with Warren Buffett and John Boyles and Pete Peterson and other major business leaders who issued a call for policies to reverse Wall Street short-termism, starting with a financial transaction tax. You see, a consumer protection agency must have real teeth. It has to have the power to oversee anyone who sells mortgages and credit cards, banks and non-banks alike, power to end redlining and equity stripping and predatory lending. Let me tell you one story. We were in Atlanta, and an elderly woman told us that she lived on $1,182 in fixed income. They gave her a loan. The loan required her to pay back $900 every month. She got a penalty if she paid it back early. She got a penalty if she reformed it in any way to make the terms better for her. And just as everybody suspected, she lost that home and everything that went with it. That's the type of predatory lending that we have to end. That's what we're fighting for. You see, we're fighting to redeem the promise of America, an America that rewards work as well as investment, an America that gives everybody an opportunity to work hard and to succeed, an America that still holds out the dream of home ownership. And we intend to fight for this just America, along with millions of motivated union members and citizens. We're going to fight for an economy and social justice in our nation and in our communities. That's what the labor movement's all about. That's what we've always done. We're going to raise the voice of millions of Americans who have been left out, pushed aside, knocked down, and stepped on. We're going to fight for a better America, and with your help, we're going to win it.
When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet. Things are different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers, all the highways were shut down. The cars were stuck in the garage, CEOs on breaks, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
David Rovics, Minimum Wage Strike.
There was no one. And we're turning our attention to the issue of low-wage workers who are routinely denied overtime pay and are paid less than the minimum wage, according to a new study based on a survey of workers in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago.
The study, the most comprehensive examination of wage law violations in a decade, concludes that the sheer breadth of the problem, spanning key industries in the economy, as well as its profound impact on workers, entailing significant economic hardship, demands urgent attention.
So, Scrooge bosses steal from low-wage workers, with James DeFilippis, Associate Professor, Blaustein School of Planning and Public Policy at Rutgers University.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to ask before we get into the substance. Now, this was the most comprehensive study in a decade. Talk about the study. Talk about how rigorous it is, what went into it.
We put together a survey instrument that we surveyed 4,400 workers in the three cities, 1,500 workers per city, basically, for New York, Chicago, and L.A. County, actually, not L.A. City itself. In the survey, we didn't actually ask workers to tell us whether or not they had a violation. What we did is we compiled very detailed accounting of everything that worker had done the prior week in terms of the hours that they had worked, how much they were compensated, and whether or not they had breaks. And then ourselves calculated whether or not violations occurred. And then we also asked questions over a longer period of time for rarer events for the past year and over the past 3 years as well to get information for about events that would not be likely to happen in any given week, but do happen.
Very often we focus on the individual characteristics of workers that make them vulnerable to low wages. But I think what was a real essential departure and most important here was the concentration on the nature of jobs and the industry and the enablers in government that work to create and keep people in low-wage jobs with, of course, enormous wage and hour violations. And I'd love you to speak more about that, because I think that is somewhat different than much of the way I've seen things characterized previously about low-wage work.
Different types of workers are experiencing workplace violations at different rates. So foreign-born workers had higher rates of violation than native-born workers. But one of the things that we did is, because we had such a large survey, we were able to do a whole set of analyses of what predicts a violation, what drives violations. And what we found was that the industry that you were in and the occupation that you work within that industry was a much stronger predictor of violations than what your characteristics as a worker might be, or whether or not you were a man or a woman, or your immigration status, or your race or ethnicity, or those kinds of characteristics.
Okay. James, what are some of those indicators so we can flesh that out more?
Well, sure. I mean, there are a set of different ones. First of all, we should say that this is an issue, and we were really surprised at how significant the rates of violations were. I mean, that we were looking at minimum wage violations of 26%, overtime violation rates of 76% of workers that worked more than 40 hours didn't get time and a half, had an overtime violation. And there were a set of industries and occupations that were much worse than other industries and occupations. For instance, and it's not shocking to people, the private household industry, that is, people who are doing housekeeping and childcare for a private household, had higher rates of violations than pretty much any other industry.
Domestic workers.
Exactly, uh-huh. Domestic workers. Garment apparel, this sort of classic, iconic image of the sweatshop. We definitely saw that with minimum wage violation rates in those industries well above 40%. And in other industries, violation rates were much lower. Lower, but still significant. Things like residential construction, they were about a third of that. So in one way, that's a kind of, the industry and the occupation driving the violation, or the kind of industry-wide violation. For instance, you could say basically overtime is a voluntary thing for a whole set of industries, that if you're an employer and you're given time and a half, it's pretty much voluntary, because industry standard is not to give time and a half beyond 40 hours. Back of the house workers in restaurants, for instance. But there are also other kinds of ways that work is organized that really lead to violations or greatly enable those violations to occur. For instance, workers who were paid hourly had much lower rates of violations, both minimum wage and overtime violations, than workers who were paid by some other way, whether they were paid by the piece, garment manufacturing or a presser. I mean, if a presser's getting a quarter to press a pair of pants, they're getting a quarter to press a pair of pants in the first hour or in the 43rd hour. They're not getting time and a half, for the 43rd hour. It's a pair of pants. So how the work is compensated becomes centrally important, whether or not employees are paid in cash or they're paid by company check. And to be clear, it's actually not a violation to pay a worker in cash. That in and of itself is not a problem. It becomes a violation in the three states if you don't provide documentation with the cash, a statement of deductions that took place from your payment. But paying in cash, people talk about it sort of casually as paying in cash as the thing, and actually paying in cash is not itself a violation. It is very, very strongly correlated with violations, and is usually payment in cash is taking place because violations are occurring, or the employer is deciding to commit violations of labor law, and this is a good way to make it not transparent.
Well, we're talking about minimum wage, which I know the minimum wage now is 7 1/4 an hour. I don't know what it was exactly when your study was done, but it was...
It was in the three states, because we used a state's minimum wage because they were higher than the federal. The study was done in the first half of 2008, and it should be clear that was actually before the collapse of Lehman, before technically after the recession began, but before the worst effects of the recession were really felt.
So it's much worse now.
But the minimum wage at the time in New York was $7.15, in Illinois was $7.50, and in California was $8.
So just to focus on the wage now, are you talking about paying below minimum wage and not paying time and a half for overtime? Now, what does that do? I mean, how significant is it for the population of workers that we're talking about in terms of how much money they take home?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the incredible things, incredible because we were really blown away by the magnitude, not just how prevalent violations were, but the magnitude of those violations when they occurred. For the workers that had an overtime violation that worked more than 40 hours without getting time and a half, the average number of hours beyond the 40th that they worked was 11 hours. I mean, it's an astonishing. So, you know, so they were working 51 hours without getting time and a half for the 11 hours beyond it. In terms of minimum wage violations, 60% of those with a minimum wage violation were getting paid less than a dollar below the minimum wage. And the numbers went down from there in terms of, and so it was very significant. When you sort of pull everything together, and one of the remarkable things that we did in the survey is we aggregated the data. And our survey, our 4,400 workers, is a representative sample, 15% of the total workforce in the three cities, the bottom third of the frontline workers, non-managerial, non-professional, non-technical, the ones who are governed by the laws in question here. And so that population is 1.6 million workers in the three cities combined. You know, so it's a sizable population that we have a representative sample of. In the prior week, before we interviewed each worker, when you aggregate all of the violations, 68% of the workers had some kind of pay-related violation. That means we're looking at 1.1 million workers in the three cities that had some kind of pay violation in the prior week. The average violation for that group was a little bit more than $50 for the week. So, okay, you got 1.1 million workers with a pay violation, and it's a little more than $50 per worker that has a violation. And we're talking about, when you pull them all together, you know, low-wage workers in the three cities losing more than $56 million per week. The numbers are kind of staggering when you realize the magnitude of wealth that is being taken from not just low-income workers in this case. It also then becomes, it's blown up to a community issue in terms of how much money low-wage workers are able to have to consume in their community, what family members get. It's not just the workers themselves then.
And we should say that it goes from, and one of the foremost is the apparel and textile manufacturing. You've got personal and repair services, the retail and drug stores, the grocery stores, the security industry, food and furniture manufacturing, the restaurants, so home health aides, good gracious, yes, home health aides, and home health care in general, social assistance, an incredible number. Well, one of the things that we haven't touched on, we've looked a little bit at the industry and some of the indicators there and some of the conclusions, but the report is broken laws and unprotected workers. So let's go to the broken laws and the enabling factor of government in this terrifying dilemma of really ripped off and ripped up low-wage workers.
Before I actually get to the public, mm-hmm. I just want to, I mean, I thank you for bringing up the breadth of the industries that we were talking about here. These are industries that cut across the whole range of our urban economies at this point. In fact, in, you know, post-industrial urban economies, these are the industries that are at the heart of what we do in cities at this point. This is not a fringe process. This is not just on the margins or anything like this. This is very much what we do in cities at this point. And I think that right. needs to be emphasized here. In terms of government enabling, well, there are a whole set of ways in which the government has been very much part of the problem. I mean, if you look at federal DOL, Department of Labor, wage and hour inspectors, they're down by a third from 1980 to 2007, and yet the number of workers has grown by well over 50% in that period, and the number of establishments has grown comparably. And so you have a limited number of workers. If OSHA, and unfortunately we were not able to measure OSHA violations.
Right, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
Yeah, worker safety and health violations, because quite frankly those laws are really, really arcane and get very, very, very specific to each occupation, and we couldn't. It would have taken up too much time in a survey. But if OSHA inspectors at current staffing levels were to inspect all of the workplaces in the United States, it would take them 133 years to do one visit You know, and so we're clearly not anywhere close to where we need to be in terms of enforcement. The other, of course, government enabling framework is an immigration policy that leaves us with somewhere between 11 and 12 million people in the country that are structurally put at a disadvantage. And we have a Department of Labor that has been unwilling, and it's certainly able to if it wanted to, but unwilling to create a clear firewall between it what it does and what DOL, Department of Labor inspectors do, and what the ICE does. And, you know, the Department of Labor is not an immigration enforcement agency. It is a labor enforcement agency. And yet it has been unwilling to create that firewall, to act accordingly, and is therefore undermine the organizing capacity of workers and the bargaining position of workers.
Well, I think we've really just skimmed the surface on this. I wish we had a lot more time, but people can get more information and read the report. How?
By going to unprotectedworkers.org. That's unprotectedworkers.org. The report is available free for downloading. Their contact information, particularly my colleagues at the National Employment Law Project, who have really in many ways been at the forefront of these issues.
And in the last 30 seconds, if you had to make one major recommendation for rectification, what would you suggest?
I would strongly suggest proactive enforcement. Waiting for workers to complain is simply not working. Look at the industries, understand the industries where the violations are taking place, and proactively enforce labor laws in those industries.
Well, let's hope it doesn't become like waiting for Godot. And I really recommend getting Broken Laws, Unprotected Workers, because this is what should we be doing, what we should be doing. This is about social justice and uplifting our communities.
I'm still waiting for Lefty.
Oh, you're such a wise guy.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to particularly thank James D. Philippus, who is an associate professor of planning and public policy at Rutgers University. It's a very, very important study, and we'll have you back to talk more about the implications. It really is kind of critical.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.